Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So the priority is that we need to make cannabis dealing less lucrative. That is a problem at the moment. And it's becoming even more easy to get into since dealing has moved on to social media.
Hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm John Ashmore, the editor of CapEx. This week is the latest instalment in our Liberalism in Europe series, exploring the many different challenges to freedom on the continent. Our topic is the way the UK approaches drugs. Should we legalise them, decriminalise them, or keep the status quo? And if we do change things, which substances should be allowed and which would remain prohibited? What have countries that have changed their drug laws experienced, and what might the UK learn from them? To answer all these questions, I brought together Lizzie McCulloch from VaultFAS, a campaign group calling for reform of drug laws, and Dan Pryor, the head of programmes at the Adam Smith Institute. I began by asking Dan what the distinction is between legalisation and decriminalisation of drugs.
The big difference between the two is that whilst decriminalisation removes the criminal penalties associated with drug possession, it does absolutely nothing on the supply side of the market. So it doesn't take back control of illegal supply and put it in the hands of regulated businesses. And that's one of the big problems with decriminalisation. Why, although it might be, and in fact, I think it is an improvement on what we have as a status quo, it still doesn't tackle some of the problems around the violence in the illicit market, the lack of regulation around products and various other issues.
I mean, how much confidence? I mean, the Adam Smith Institute is one of the think tanks which tends towards a smaller state. And here, is there a conflict, a slight kind of theoretical conflict there between advocating a policy which actually sort of empowers the state in this area?
Well, it depends on how you do it. There's a huge debate that's going on in drug reform circles around the world and also in the UK about what sort of model legal regulation, especially of cannabis, should actually take. And on the one side of things, you've got more of a state control, public health focused angle. And on the other side of things, you've got the kind of goals of more free market liberals, which tend to focus on eliminating the criminal market. And also providing some level of consumer choice, especially for relatively lower risk illicit drugs like cannabis. So the kind of classic example of where I think the state-led approach can go wrong is Uruguay, which was the first country in the world to legalize cannabis earlier this decade. And one of the problems with Uruguay is that it introduced a whole host of measures in legalization, which are extremely strict regulations on cannabis there. So there was very few vendors that could actually sell cannabis. It was all grown by the state and still is. The majority is still grown by the state, I believe. But there's things like price controls in there. So there's a whole host of interventions. And the cumulative effect of these has been actually to undermine one of the key goals of legalization, which is to combat the illicit market. The amount of shortages of cannabis in Uruguay post-legalization that continue to this day were caused by some of this state intervention that made it more difficult to get enough supply onto the market. So we're very keen that when we advocate for cannabis legalization, especially as we did in our recent paper, The Green Light, that we propose a model which takes account of the fact that too much state control can undermine a lot of the key arguments in favor of legalization.
Yeah, I just want to interrogate this a bit more. We talked about cannabis already. I mean, where does the line come between why you would campaign to legalize one drug and not another? I mean, is it to do with physiological harm? Is it to do with where it's produced? so if we legalized, I don't know, cocaine or something, and it was still illegal to produce it in Bolivia, that's going to create a bit of a problem. Where do you stand on that, Lizzie?
Yeah, so the the thing about cannabis is that it is safer than alcohol, and it's safer than tobacco. And so Voltfast is making the case to regulate a drug which is safer than other legal drugs we have out there. And so I think sometimes in this debate, there can be this tension at times between people who want to implement a very state-led model. They're very worried about use going up, and they see that as increasing harm. And what we would say is actually, we're very interested in displacement. And if people are using cannabis more, does that mean they're using alcohol less? And so there is, by seeing an increase in use, I see that as a positive thing, because where are we seeing less use in substances? Whereas cocaine can kill you, and it is, as can MDMA, and as can many other stimulants. And that's why we can't just rush into it and say, well, let's just treat all drugs the same, because they are different. And we do need to be more considered and recognise that a different regulatory model would need to be introduced for cocaine on MDMA or speed, but maybe not. And that's something that we need to start a conversation about.
Can I perhaps make an analogy about this? And it's related to immigration policy. A lot of free market liberals will talk about being pro-open borders. But in that particular debate, what that translates into in actual policy terms is gradual reforms and gradually moving towards a more liberalized immigration system. And there's a similar thing that I think should be happening when it comes to drug policy reform, is that we have the evidence base for legalizing and regulating cannabis. It's a very strong evidence base. And we have the general kind of more theoretical arguments as to why that is likely to transfer to other drugs, although, of course, different drugs should be regulated in different ways in any sort of legal system. But we still need to move slowly, and we need to move as the evidence comes in, and we need to constantly be taking stock of where the kind of evidence comes in as we make policy changes. And there is kind of, it's not just cannabis where we're seeing reform around the world. I mean, we had the recent decriminalization of magic mushrooms, for example, in Denver, I believe it was. And there's a lot of other similar efforts that are going on. Obviously, Portugal, with its full decriminalization of all drugs a fair while ago now, that's, by all intents and purposes, been a huge success in terms of achieving its aims. So there is emerging evidence about other drugs. It's not just cannabis where we have an evidence base. It's just that it needs to be stronger before we talk about legal regulation.
Where is the kind of climate of public opinion on this in the UK? I mean, how realistic do you think it is to get that we might see some legislative action over the next few years?
Yeah, so if we're talking about all drugs, there is very low support to legally regulate all drugs in the UK. I think it's something like 12%.
Right.
If we're talking about cannabis, it's a very different situation. So, and we're seeing support increase rapidly month by month. So in May 2018, before the Billy Caldwell campaign and before medical cannabis was legalised, support was pretty equal. So 43% of the UK supported legalisation and 41% didn't. And that was actually, people got quite excited about that, because they were saying, oh my God, 2% more people support legalisation than oppose. Wow, we've never had that before. It's always been pretty much equal. Whereas now what we're seeing, so YouGov, 1 year later, asked the exact same question, same polling company, and now it's 53%. Who support the legalisation of cannabis. So a 10% increase.
And that's full legalisation, not decriminalisation.
Absolutely
that's...
not. No, that is full legalisation. Yeah. And so what we're seeing now is actually 31% of the UK oppose this policy and the rest don't know. So that's quite a striking figure, I would say.
It's interesting to break that down by political party as well, because for the longest time looking into this debate, I was sure that it would be Labour would kind of be fairly pro. The Lib Dems, obviously, with their explicit policy, would be very pro, and the Tories would be very anti. But there's been some recent polling done by the Conservative Drug Policy Reform Group, who looked at the party breakdown and found that actually it's Conservatives are split roughly evenly on this. There's support in the 30-35% range, and there's opposition in exactly the same range. And then there's a lot of don't knows or undecideds in the middle. So the kind of political will behind this, I think, is starting to get stronger as well. I mean, when I'm having conversations with MPs from all parties, but more recently I've been chatting to some Conservative MPs who shall remain nameless for the purposes of this podcast, who are not the sort of people that you'd traditionally associate with cannabis legalization or supporting it. And yet, in private conversations, they're more than happy to discuss that they accept the case for reform, full legalization. It's just that there hasn't been the cover, the political moment for them to come out and support this yet.
Yeah, it always struck me, one of the things about Theresa May is she was always really fiercely against this, and that perhaps stopped it in its tracks for a little while, both at the Home Office and then subsequently as Prime Minister. Whereas I think I would make no aspersions about Boris Johnson's personal habits, but he doesn't strike me as the kind of person who would be particularly fussed. That's a fair assessment.
I think that's perfectly fair characterisation. I mean, he's been on record in the past supporting cannabis reform. Admittedly, this was a fair while ago. But I think of all the kind of Tory senior figures that would ever come out and say, yes, I'm going to legalise cannabis, Bojo's got to be up there as one of them. He is, by all accounts, a liberal on many issues, if you look at immigration as well. So the hope is that if there's the political moment and opportunity for it, then we might see some reform coming from the Conservative Party. And I mean, you look at the other parties, Labour, for example, have for a while kind of been umming and ahhing about decriminalisation, which, although better than the status quo, is not what will solve the problems with illicit supply. And recently they've ended up calling for a royal commission on all drugs, which was cautiously welcomed, I think, by drug policy reform campaigners. Because on the one hand, with a royal commission, you've got the opportunity to kind of have that political cover to make change, to make policy change in this area. But it takes a long time. And more often than not, the kind of discourse around it tends to be very much public health and decriminalization focused again. So for me, I think the best chance of getting cannabis legalization through is not through a royal commission, not getting it through in a timely manner as well. It would be policy just put forward by one of the major parties, just doing it, basically.
But I would say, I think Labour's decision to have a royal commission, I think that was them dipping their toe in the water. I think that Labour have been very silent on drugs, unusually, some would say. And I think that when that decision was made at a senior level to endorse the position, I think there might be an expectation that there was going to be an outcry, that the Daily Mail was going to be after them, and no one was that bothered.
There was radio silence.
Yeah, there was radio silence.
Quite surprised, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think they must have been quite surprised. And so my expectation is that they now see the way is clear to go a bit further. So I think Labour could definitely be legalised cannabis. And I totally agree. I think that not only is cannabis legalisation in keeping with Boris's values, I also think it's a vote winner for him. Because as we saw gay marriage under Cameron, it was a policy that he endorsed. It didn't really have the support of his membership, of his voters really, but it was a way to engage.
Yeah. So we could have, fund the NHS, hang the pedos, legalise weed. Yeah. The ultimate triangulation.
Pure populism party, right?
Yeah, it's a very strange. I mean, let's talk a bit about what are the demographics. I mean, I would imagine instinctively that people under 30 are overwhelmingly in favour. I mean, is that borne out by the research?
So what's really interesting is for the first time, which, again, I referenced that YouGov poll where it showed 53% support legalisation of cannabis. Yes, definitely. In the past, this has been a young person issue where young people want to legalise, older people say, no, we don't want to do that. Now, if you look at every age demographic, apart from people who are over 65, the majority support the legalisation of cannabis. And that's never happened before.
What's the over 65 figure now?
Equal.
Really?
Yeah, okay. So it's not even the case that there's majority opposition, it's equal.
I suppose now you're getting people in their 60s who grew up in the 60s.
Yes.
For whom it's pretty much normal. And we've talked a bit earlier on about kind of ways you could do this. Is there a country or a state where you think, right, they've absolutely nailed it?
I don't think that there's one particular state or country that you should point to and say, we're going to transplant this model from there to here and not change anything. It's got to be a uniquely British approach. If you look at somewhere like Canada, for example, issues related to potency were just not an issue. They were not part of the discourse around cannabis legalization at the time last year. And yet for the UK, that seems to be a much more salient issue for people involved, kind of concerns around mental health, psychosis, etc. So you have to kind of take account of public preferences in the model if you're going to get any sort of buy-in, if you're going to have any sort of success with it. At the same time, I think that there's lessons that we can learn from pretty much everywhere that's legalized, some positive lessons and some negative ones. I mean, Canada being able to inform users about the kind of strength and potency and the health effects of cannabis with every purchase is, I think, a really good thing. Informed consumers is never a bad thing. You get a kind of handout with every cannabis product that you purchase. If you look at some of the US states, what they've done on taxation, I think there's lessons to be learned there as well. Without getting too wonky, there's important things related to whether you should tax weight or the value of cannabis. It sounds boring, but if you end up taxing the weight of cannabis, you're incentivizing growers to grow higher strength stuff. That's not necessarily what you want to be doing. So you should tax the value instead. And also the rates of taxation as well are very important. If you look at somewhere like California, which started off initially with very high levels of taxation, it really struggled to make an impact on the criminal market. And they responded to this by reducing the overall rates of taxation. And there's various states have taken different approaches, but the general lesson from it seems to be that if you want to be able to have the legal market compete with the very well-established criminal market, you've got to make sure it's competitive on price. You've also got to make sure it's competitive on accessibility as well. So, you know, I grew up near South End, and a lot of my friends at school, they could basically text someone or, you know, send someone a Facebook message and they'd be at their door in 20 minutes with a 10 bag of weed. And unless the legal market is able to have some way of competing with that, then again, it's going to be a massive disadvantage. You're not going to displace people from the criminal market into regulated markets. So there's a lot of different lessons that we can learn.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, and I think what I would say is that I totally agree. A legal market needs to compete with the illicit market on price, accessibility, and also experience. It needs to be a nice experience for the consumer, for them to want to go to the legal market. However, what I would add is that I think the UK debate needs to mature in the understanding that introducing a legal regulated market is a process. So Canada legalised in October 2018, and then we took MPs over there for a study trip and then brought them back, and we invited the BBC to make a documentary out of the trip. And so when I came back and I was doing sort of media interviews on it in the summer, the question that I kept getting asked was, but it's a failure, isn't it? Because there's still an illicit market. And what there's not the understanding is that when Canada legalised, I think there was 10% legal sales, 90% illegal. And then it moved to, I think, 30%, and then it moved to 47%. And for me, that's progress. And yes, I think the Canadian government is learning lessons, and the province is learning lessons, that they need to loosen it up in order for licensed producers to operate effectively. More stores need to be opening up. The price needs to go down. But it's a process and it's something that will take time. And I think Connect Canada are very realistic about the fact that it's going to take quite a few years before they can say that they've got a thriving legal cannabis market.
Do you envisage it? It seems that in a lot of places it has to be sort of bought or sold in a specific place. Is that the kind of... Why is that particular way of doing things seemingly popular rather than just selling it in the same way as tobacco or alcohol in a supermarket? Or
I think there's an element of wanting staff to have a better familiarity with cannabis, especially considering that, you know, for a long time under prohibition, we've had a huge lack of awareness about the health effects of cannabis, even about the difference between THC and CBD. For the listeners who are unaware, THC is the stuff that gets you high. CBD is the stuff that some evidence suggests protects against psychoactive, some negative psychosis effects. And yeah, in our model and the Adam Smith Institute's model, we do say, well, it should be sold in regulated online outlets, subject to age checks, of course. Specialized stores, and perhaps in some cases your kind of Boots or Super Drug pharmacy stores. So having some level of staff training or some level of information on a website that is able to inform consumers better. Now, it's possible to kind of in theory go to, well, you can pop into Tesco and you can buy a joint. And I mean, for me at least, and this is where me and Lizzie may disagree, I'm not sure. In an ideal world, I think that that might not be the worst option. I think that accessibility. Ultimately, cannabis is a fairly low-harm consumer product. It's enjoyable for a lot of people. Adults should be able to get it in those sort of circumstances. But again, legalization is a process, and that simply doesn't have the political buy-in in the UK. I think it's very unlikely to. And one of the reasons is that people are concerned that they don't want increased use overall. I think that concern is misplaced, but it's one that tends to dominate the debate.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of pick up on that point. I mean, what evidence is there that legalization or decriminalization does it lessen the kind of cachet for kids, especially, of doing something a bit rebellious and naughty? Does it have any effect on use?
So the effect it has on use is that the age group where we're going to see an increase in use is people who are over 50. And so people who are most deterred by our current cannabis laws. So if our policy goal was, God, we really need to make sure that the over 55s are not smoking cannabis, then we could say we're actually doing an all right job.
So nursing homes could have a really different vibe.
Yeah.
Exactly. Much better vibe, arguably.
Yeah.
And so if that was our policy goal, then yeah, maybe prohibitionists could make a good case. But our goal should be that it's children who should not be using cannabis, and that's where we don't do a very good job.
Right.
So we know that from polling that we've done that children can access cannabis easier than alcohol. Dealers don't ask for ID. They can just go to someone in their school or someone in their community who they can buy it from. And actually, when you legalise, what you do is you regulate, and it means that if you take it out of the illicit market, and again, the priority has to be to shrink that illicit market so young people can't go to those dealers, and you bring it into a regulated setting where children can't buy it. And so what they've seen in the US states where they've legalized, there's been a 10% reduction in use among teenagers, whereas in states that haven't legalized, they've seen an increase in use.
I wonder what, just slightly play devil's advocate here. I mean, one of the advantages you see of doing this is to sort of take money out of the hands of criminals. Is there any risk that that will just drive them to look elsewhere to increase the market in other illegal drugs?
So the priority is that we need to make cannabis dealing less lucrative. That is the problem at the moment. And it's becoming even more easy to get into since dealing has moved on to social media. So that's a report that we did quite recently that demonstrated that actually young people increasingly seeing drug adverts on social media. And it's a very easy way for anyone to become a dealer. You buy a bit of extra cannabis and they just sell it on social media and sell it to your network. And also there is a limit of how much. So something that people say is, oh, they'll just go on and sell heroin or they'll go on and sell cocaine. There's a limit to how much demand there is for heroin and cocaine. And so again, that's not potentially a very lucrative area to go into. And also, it's not our job to give criminals stuff that they can sell. That is not our goal. Because if it was, what we could say is, actually, cannabis, illicit cannabis is quite harmful. Why don't we make something else illegal that's less harmful, and then actually maybe we're reducing overall harm?
Right. I think another point to make on this, because it's, for me, I don't think that it doesn't convince me, but it's one of the stronger arguments against legalization, that actually you're going to find the substitution effect where cannabis dealers who used to just do a cannabis start dealing cocaine or heroin or harder drugs, and actually harm goes up. The reason that I'm not convinced by it is it simply isn't borne out. If you look at crime statistics post-legalization, if you look at the best evidence and studies into the difference pre and post-legalization. So even on something like medical marijuana, for example, in the US, there's a good study out a few years ago that looked at the violent crime rates in US states that bordered Mexico once they'd legalized medical cannabis, and found a fairly significant reduction the closer they were to the border as well. In areas closest to the border, there was a significant reduction in violent crime. And the explanation that the authors gave for this is fairly simple. They were undermining the profits of the cartels through legalization. Now, if the kind of substitution effect was strong, then we'd expect actually, well, these cartels might move away from cannabis and simply all of that effort and resources goes into other drugs. But the fact that there was a reduction in crime suggests that's not the case, and actually the undermining of criminal profits outweighs any sort of substitution that we might have.
And also, just to add, it is important to involve people who participated in the illicit market in the legal market. So I think there's a strong agreement in North America that people who've been criminalized for possession of cannabis should be pardoned or expunged and allowed to participate by getting a license in the legal market. There is more of a debate in North America around whether people who were dealing in the legal market should be able to have a license. And that's something that we need to have more of a conversation about in the UK. And it's something they're grappling with over there.
From a personal basis, I'm very pro that. You've got this group of people who are extremely entrepreneurial, shall we say, albeit on the wrong side of the law, and whose human capital could make for a far more effective and successful legal cannabis industry if they were able to enter it. And I guess it depends on your kind of wider views of criminal justice as to whether, you know, this is more about punishment, even though that punishment will have been removed in a legalized system, or whether it's more about actually encouraging people to get involved in the job market.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's also important to recognize that dealers are very different. There are different types of dealers. You've got people sort of at the top who are involved in serious organized crime and human trafficking. And then you've got people who, again, are more entrepreneurs and just buy more weed than they need and sell it to their network. And that's very different.
It's a good cutoff that as well. If you want to not allow the kind of high level organized crime to transfer into the legal market, then you just say, well, if it's purely a cannabis supply offense, if there's nothing else going on, then that's the way to do it, and that would be okay. If you've been involved in any other sort of organized crime, which should be frowned upon, then no, sorry.
So I mean, we've focused understandably a lot on cannabis so far, but you mentioned earlier, Lizzie, Portugal, which has decriminalized all drugs. I mean, what's their experience been, and what can we learn on both sides there?
So the experience has been that in a public health sense, drug-related harm went down. So the reason why Portugal decriminalised all drugs was because in the late 90s, they had the highest HIV rate in Europe and very high drug-related deaths. And so it was considered to be a public health emergency. They thought, okay, we just need to take a new approach with this. And what they did was they said, let's treat problematic drug use as a health issue, not as a criminal justice issue. And by decriminalising, we're removing barriers that are obstructing people from accessing help and support. There's no statistically significant evidence that shows there's been an increase in use from decriminalising drugs.
Okay, so it's been sort of broadly positive, but
yes, but as Dan said,
not a miracle cure for it.
No, because at the end of the day, there's still a thriving illicit market, and something the work that Voltfast does is to try and communicate to a UK audience that illicit markets are not acceptable, and that we shouldn't say, oh, we're always going to have an illicit market, they're not really that bad. They actually suit people in a lot of ways. So it's okay for them to exist. And we say that's not okay.
Yeah, I feel like I knocked decriminalisation a little too much earlier in the recording. I do think that, I mean, the evidence from Portugal is very clear, and a significant reduction in overdose deaths, a significant reduction in HIV and other STI prevalence rates. It's been a massive success on public health grounds. Although there is this, I guess I struggle to come to terms with the data on there not being an increase in overall use. I mean, there'd certainly be a reduction in problem use.
Yeah.
But again, you know, our personal experience is no substitute for hard data. But whenever I've been to Lisbon, I've always found the kind of the visibility of drugs, it seems to be much higher. You know, just people openly dealing on the streets in broad daylight and things like this. Now, a lot of people's concerns, I don't necessarily share them. I don't really care very much either way, but a lot of people's concerns in the UK about legalization or any sort of drug reform is the idea of it being more visible on the streets. So people smoking cannabis on the streets, or people dealing cannabis in broad daylight and things like that. So that's maybe one of the concerns that I would have with any sort of decriminalization, is that actually it would poison the well against other drug reform, because people would get sick to death of seeing people, you know, openly dealing on the streets, which they do already, to be fair. But that's one of the worries, and why I think politically speaking, as well as just in policy terms, it's better to legalize.
Yeah, because it's interesting. So not a criticism, but something that politicians might say about the UK is that we have de facto decriminalization, which isn't true, because actually there's just a lot of, there's a postcode lottery in terms of where you're going to get criminalised for cannabis possession, where you're not. But if you look at the constabularies where you've seen a decline in the criminalisation of possession offences, chances are you also see a decline in the criminalisation of supply offences. And I think it's quite, as Dan said, if police stop criminalising possession, it also sort of means that dealing on the street is also sort of permitted in a sense. I think overall drugs as a whole become a bit deprioritized.
Yeah. I mean, we did have a literal one, postcode lottery went in Brixton about 15 years ago.
Depenalization.
Yes. They actually decided they weren't going to bother going after it. I mean, if you've ever come out of Brixton Tube, you'll know that kind of remains the case.
Yeah, I live in Camberwell and I know the
right
feeling,
yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, just returning to the kind of broader European theme, in this podcast, I should add, is part of a series that we're doing in CapEx about illiberalism in Europe. I mean, where do you think the continent as a whole is? Is there a kind of dividing line between perhaps more authoritarian countries and their attitude to this? I mean, where do you see that kind of divide?
I can see Europe moving a lot quicker than North America has in terms of the because if we go back to cannabis, what typically happens is a country will do legalize medical cannabis, and then maybe a few years will go by, there'll have to be an established sort of patient population, they'll all be accessing medical cannabis. And that is the way that people in North America see the way that legalization will happen in Europe. But actually, that doesn't seem to be the case. So Luxembourg legalized medical cannabis in June 2018. A very recent decision, and now they've just said, actually, we're going to go ahead and legalize recreational. There hasn't been that need to wait until there's been this patient population. It feels like what might happen in Europe is we just crack on with it, because we're seeing all this emerging evidence from North America. We're seeing how much of a success has been. So there's a feeling of, do we have to wait?
But will that be a Western European phenomenon, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it's looking at this point. I think if we look at the countries where there's most sort of discussions and appetite for reform, it does seem to be more Western Europe.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it an iron curtain, but it's certainly, you know, a divide between East and West on this. So if you look at, you know, Portugal, although they haven't legalized cannabis, there was recent efforts to, a couple of years ago, I think, to actually legalize and build on their decriminalization. In Spain, there's a lot of movements towards legalization, and they already have kind of a fairly liberal system there, looking at cannabis social clubs and things like that. France, the Netherlands especially, I mean, they've had this toleration policy where people aren't prosecuted for growing or selling or possessing, but even that they've recently started trials and experiments with legal and regulated supply, whereas in the past that wasn't the case. And then, of course, yeah, Luxembourg, which has just come out of the woodwork, and I think very few people were following it before they made the announcement, to be honest. It was just a real shock to everyone. They're aiming to get that done by 2021. And then further afield, of course, we've got New Zealand as well. They're holding a referendum on it, which should take place in the last few months of 2020. So there's definitely worldwide momentum.
And what do you think the kind of, just to finish, what do you think the kind of economic impact would be? You talk about the tax take and things, but, you know, is there potential for a, if you like, green industrial revolution?
I think we shouldn't get too focused on tax revenue. It seems to be that before a country legalized, that seemed to be the boon to do it. It's, we can get 1 billion in taxation. Yes, we will get more taxes from legalizing, but if we focus on that as an achievement, what that might mean is that we're not able to make it price competitive and we tax it too highly, and it means it doesn't compete with the illicit market. And for me, there's no point legalising cannabis if we're still going to have an illicit market. That should be our priority, to eliminate that.
So the taxing is a pleasant side effect rather than the main reason.
I'd say an unpleasant side effect myself.
I think what we need to focus on is the fact that we will be embracing a new industry. So when we were organising Strip in Canada, we hired someone on the ground to help us with it. And she was saying that actually, since legalization, what Canadians have realized is how, what's the word? I think that the population has really valued the emergence of this industry. So this mayor from this town called Smiths Falls, who in the early 2000s, most of its jobs came from the Hershey factory, which shut down after the recession, and the town lost 2/3 of its jobs. And then with that, loads of problems sort of came to the town. There was problems with addiction there. And then I think in 2014-15, they were approached by a cannabis company who said, can we come in and basically set up this cultivation site? We want to bring a whole range of different jobs here. And he said they were desperate. And so they said, okay, fine, well you can come in. And it's completely turned the town around.
Yeah. They should probably reopen the Hershey's factory.
Sorry?
Oh, yeah. there's a distributional impact as well when it comes to jobs in the cannabis industry. So a lot of different US states and Canada as well have experimented with equity programs. So the idea of trying to involve communities that were disproportionately impacted by criminalization more in the legal regulated market. But I was speaking to one of the cannabis regulators in Massachusetts a few weeks ago, and she comes from the kind of the left of politics more generally, but she really surprised me. She made the point that, well, we've got all these different states trying equity programs, but actually the ones like Oklahoma, which have fairly lax licensing restrictions, they're actually more successful just letting people enter the market easier than these equity programs. So it has the potential to really deliver a positive outcome for low-income communities and people of colour as well.
All right. Well, on that very positive note, I'll bid you both farewell. Thank you very much. And stay tuned for the next episode of Free Exchange.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.